Welcome to Global Real Estate Dealmakers with Kyle Ney, showcasing investors and entrepreneurs across the globe who are leading innovative commercial and residential real estate projects. You will have the chance to go around the world and hear from international visionaries who are shaping their local communities. Having worked at some of the world's largest real estate investment firms, Kyle is excited to have you alongside as he speaks with dealmakers about their backgrounds, current real estate projects, and views on both the opportunities and risks of the local markets. Okay, grab your bag. It's time to board the flight for the next episode.
Hey there, listeners. The episode that you're about to hear was so fun for me to record for two primary reasons. One, I got to speak with the extremely accomplished, thoughtful, and altruistic Gloria Gill about her career in U.S. real estate investment. And two, I had the chance to chat with her about her upbringing in the Philippines and how real estate in her hometown of Manila has fared during COVID-19. At the end of this past June, Gloria retired after 39 years in commercial real estate, the last 14 of which were served as a senior managing director at the Regents of the University of California, the governing board of the University of California system that has 280,000 students across 10 campuses. As you'll hear her describe, she very courageously took on the challenge in this role of building an entirely new asset class for UC's endowment, and quite remarkably grew it to a $5.5 billion real estate portfolio across separate accounts and commingled funds. More notably, she implemented the build the core separate account mandate by acquiring assets at wholesale pricing with either renovation, lease up, or repositioning issues, and selling these assets at retail upon completion of the program. Of course, she also had numerous other impressive accomplishments during previous tenures at the likes of Lacera and TCW Realty, some of which she touches on in the episode. Anyway, I'll leave it there and transition to the very, very enjoyable conversation that I had with Gloria Gill. All right. Well, Gloria, I'm very, very happy to have you on Global Real Estate Dealmakers today. I know that we've had to skirt around everything from scheduling to forest fires and you name it. So thank you so much for carving out the time. How are things going on your side?
Fine, thank you. It's a beautiful day in LA today, so no brush fires, thank God. I think we're in good shape.
Yeah, well, let's hope the situation stays that way for the next hour or so. We should be in good shape. So I want to start out with you and ask you. You have such a fascinating background, which I know from being from Manila largely has unfolded on the professional side here in the U.S. So for the listeners, could you paint the picture a bit of how your career has unfolded and your background back in the Philippines and how that led you to come over here to the U.S.?
Of course. I grew up in the Philippines and went to college there for 2 years, was an electrical engineering major. And then my mom petitioned us. She remarried, and my dad, my dad adopted all four of us. So we had to come to the U.S. And when I arrived, I was 17 years old. My parents said they could not afford to send me to college. So when I turned 18, I started working and always loved numbers. So I thought maybe accounting would be a good job to work at, and went to Aetna Life Insurance and handled the insurance for property managers for their property. So that's how I got my first taste of real estate, was working with the property managers. And one of the property managers eventually hired me as their controller.
And by the way, you said you love numbers. Did that come from any of your parents? Were they numbers people, or were you unique in that regard?
I think my mom and my dad is also kind of an electrical kind of an engineer. So I might have picked it up from him.
Okay.
And my grandpa is really into, you know, accounting and draftsman. So I think there's the right side, left side on both sides. My mom was a seamstress, dressmaker, single mom, and raised four kids all by her sewing clothes in the Philippines. We had a business in our living room. She had employed two people. Anyway, a shout out to my mom, who has been very courageous to come to America. Yeah, on a tourist visa, and then filed for divorce and met my dad, and he was wonderful. He adopted all four of us. And
typical so your other three siblings were with you at that time too.
We could only afford to get two at a time. So I came with the youngest, and then the following year, the other two followed. Typical immigrant story, saving for a plane fare for the other two. So yeah, and it was nice that we were all together again, but we were separated for 2 years from my mom. She left us with my grandparents and my aunt. So we were not really alone.
Mm-hmm. That must have been difficult nonetheless to not have her there.
It was very difficult, but I was the oldest. So I'm kind of the mother hen for the other three, and they were very good. They listened and never really caused any problems. Coming to America, I worked for Draper and Kramer in the accounting department, but eventually as a controller, they transferred me to property management and working with the budgets with the property managers. And eventually they gave me a building to manage. And of course, I managed Inland Steel Building in Chicago, and then Inland Steel hired me away from Draper and Kramer. Backtrack a little bit. I couldn't go to college, so Draper and Kramer had a work study program, and I went to school at DePaul University Night School, mm-hmm. and all my tuition was paid by Draper and Kramer. That's how I went to, it took me 10 years to get my BS degree going to night school, but the determination was there that I was part of my bucket list. So I got it.
Do you have any recollection back then, and maybe even before Draper and Kramer, when you first came over, is there anything that struck you as way different than what you expected it to be, knowing that you were coming to the US?
Yes,
whether culturally or the way the way you were received in society?
Very different. Well, my dad is English, so we lived in an Irish neighborhood of Chicago. And the first thing my dad said is, "We don't go here, we don't go there." And I'm so shocked. And I said, "Why?" You know, yeah. That was the first thing. But living in the south side of Chicago, Bridgeport is an Irish neighborhood, so it's pretty kind of segregated. Mm-hmm. And that's when we decided, when I worked for Draper and Kramer, we wanted to have a diverse environment for our children. We don't have kids yet, so we moved to Dearborn Park. I was a pioneer of Dearborn Park. Draper and Kramer developed it, and it was in a bad area in downtown Chicago. It's kind of 8th and State Street. And mm-hmm. they were giving employees a discount to.
That's what I was going to ask. Why did you go there? With chicken and the egg, did you go there? And then coincidentally, Draper and Kramer was at the forefront of redeveloping it, or did you find out about it because of Draper and Kramer? It sounds like the latter.
I went there to Draper and Kramer, just working there. And then when they finally developed it, I took advantage of it.
Yeah. Okay.
It wasn't like I went there just for the heck of it to get a mm-hmm. discount in housing. No, it was really, I was there for 5 years, and I think they started developing it on year three. So I really enjoyed working there and became a portfolio manager, overseeing other property managers. And eventually Inland Steel hired me as their facilities management person. In charge of their corporate headquarters, of their mailroom, their chauffeurs, their dining room, and the building management. So, at a young age, I was really...
A lot of responsibility.
A lot of responsibility. I was managing 50 people. They also went through some tough times, so I had to lay off people. Learned a lot, and then we moved to L.A. Moving to L.A., I got to work first with Dishman West as in property management. Mm-hmm. That's where I learned construction accounting.
And was your move to LA, was that based on career choice or opportunity, or was that a personal move that you decided to head west?
It was personal move. It was too cold for us in Chicago, and my husband was having health issues.
Okay.
So the doctor said we have to move out of Chicago for his allergies.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And LA was good. Bronchial asthma, went away, and we were fine. And we were out of work for 8 months and just traveling all over the US and the Philippines. And then we decided to finally find a job. And the first job was in accounting, construction accounting at Tishman. And then eventually Columbia Savings and Loan, managing their portfolio in Beverly Hills. And after that, TCW called and said, "Gloria, how's your job at Columbia?" And the feds are with RTC was calling. And so I finally switched to TCW as an asset manager, and then became the asset manager in charge of the CalSTRS portfolio in West LA. My portfolio was Brentwood, Century City, Santa Monica. You know,
so that was a huge step up then in terms of the responsibility that you took.
Yes.
Going from Columbia to TCW.
It was really managing. Yeah, very, very, because we were renovating each building that we acquired. So I learned a lot about seismic work, working with tenants, difficult tenants, and trying to get, you know, those complaints on renovation is pretty, pretty serious. So I learned a lot about customer relations and tenant retention programs. After TCW, I went to La Sera because the CalSTRS investment officer quit CalSTRS and moved to La Sera as the investment officer. And he said he liked what I did at TCW with his portfolio. And he is creating a new position as of head of acquisitions. Mm-hmm. They were going to grow their separate account program. And so I applied and was lucky to get accepted at La Sera and was in charge of acquisitions of the separate account portfolio. I grew that portfolio from $1 billion to $3 billion. I was there for 10 years. On year six, the head of real estate left. And I applied for the position of head of real estate and I got that position. After 10 years, but at
La Sera, I mean, we'll get to this in a second. That role had you investing in both a separate account and structure as well as into funds from
mostly separate accounts. Okay. They were really very risk averse. Mm-hmm. The policemen and firemen, they wanted only all cash as well, and we're small, medium sized assets we were acquiring.
Okay.
And then eventually, after 10 years, I said, enough of public service. I was going to go to the dark side like you. Mm-hmm. But UC Regents called and said, how would you like to do it all over again, Gloria? We don't have a real estate program. How would you like to set it up from the get-go? And that was the scary and exciting part. Of course.
In 2006 timeframe, correct?
That's right, 2006. Mm-hmm. And the timing is wrong because everything is too pricey, but I was very careful. And so I was there 14 years and left in June this year, retired, and built a $5.5 billion portfolio.
Wow, that's incredible. When you went from La Sera to UC Regents, was there anything that you noticed in terms of like difference in investment philosophy or difference in culture, your day-to-day? How did it differ?
Very different in investment style. UC, first of all, La Sera is a pension fund, so very mature. So that means they pay out more than what they take in as contributions. So the role of real estate is very important for the cash flow, the stakeholders. Mm-hmm. While in reverse, UC is not a mature fund. So they're taking in more contributions and less payouts. It's like 2-to-1. And so it was more an entrepreneurial strategy. The pension is more total return oriented and the endowment is more, you know, really high yield, value added, opportunistic. So I was really kind of investing in a different way. And plus they have leverage and also were allowed to invest in commingled funds and separate account. Actually, when I first started at UC, the program, the strategic plan, the consultant's head was all commingled funds. And within 30 days, I went to the CIO and said, I think we should do half in separate accounts and half in commingled funds. So that way we have diversification of size and region and you know, secondary markets and property types.
And was that a tough sell at the time to get approval?
No, I was so surprised because we're pretty new. Mm-hmm. She sent me to the chair of the investment committee of investment board and we talked and he approved my recommendation. They were just afraid of international. So that was the only guidance she gave me was baby steps for international. But for you, US, you know, you can recommend whatever you think would be best. And so in 2006, we were approved and did $300 million of investments only through open-end and closed-end commingled funds. And then 2007, same thing, about 400, 500. And then 2008, we stopped. We stopped investing and we had an RFI for a separate account program and allocated $1 billion to four separate account managers. We told them we're not in a hurry.
RFP that you went out with solicit interest in managing that allocation?
Yes. Oh, mm-hmm. Well, we're different though. it's by invitation only. So we,
you knew who you wanted to reach out to, like who
the four
finalists, so to speak, would be.
Yeah. We probably invited 8 and we hired 4. Mm-hmm. So it's not like 50, you know, it's open to the whole universe, but mm-hmm. we were very selective. That, and mostly some of them are ones that are separate account managers that I've already worked with at La Sera. So that came in very easy. And starting the process at at UC, we started the acquisition process, registration process, you know, there was nothing. So I hired my teammate from La Sera and brought her in, and we built the portfolio together with both separate accounts and commingled funds. And then 2010, we started investing. We invested about $1 billion in 2010. And that's essentially 400 million of public REITs that were at 65 cents of the dollar. Open-end funds, another 300 million. And we added logistics, industrial as well. And then another 300 million in separate accounts. So the wind was on our back on the separate account program. We started building it after the GFC. So it is, we've been buying assets on a build to core kind of program where core managers are allowed to do development or value add, mm-hmm. opportunistic deals. And then once it's stabilized, we keep it in the portfolio. We hold it. We've also done
Were those relationships with the separate account managers? Were they, or your partners in the deal? Were those discretionary accounts where they could go out and within a box say we're going to move forward? Or did you have to? You had to approve it, so you had to go to your investment committee, and then whatever operator you were dealing with or partner, they would have to do their own internal approvals, and then you would move forward if both were approved.
That's correct. We did not have an investment committee. We just have the CIO. So I would present to the CIO every deal. But yeah, we had to approve every deal. The manager submitted a business plan, but then we have to approve each transaction.
Got it. Okay. And it sounds like, I mean, when you came aboard at UC Regents, had a very minimal real estate presence, and you grew it to $5.5 billion, at least at its peak, before you perhaps started to sell off some of the assets. Among the four managers, and I don't need you to name each one of them, but were there certain ones that were responsible for more growth, or was it fairly equal? You know, when you look
it's at fairly
how,
open.
How did we get to? And I know you said you invested in some REITs and some other structures as well. So perhaps it came in a number of different areas. That's staggering that you're able to take it to $5.5 billion during that period.
Yeah, with a staff of 3. So mm-hmm. We also added another set of managers, separate account managers later on in the program that will do value add and opportunistic. So there was a group, 4 groups that could do all strategies, but then hold. And then there was a churning account with value add managers who would be selling at the end of the value creation. So there's mm-hmm. 2 different kind of strategies. And then also when the value add and opportunistic deals could be in the endowment, which was requiring a higher yield. And once it stabilized, we could transfer to the pension, which had a lower actuarial rate of return. So it also was very flexible to do that. You could bring assets back and forth, and it helped a lot with flexibility and being nimble.
Yes, for sure. Understood there. I want to talk about the markets that you invested in, mainly at UC Regents, although to the extent it's applicable, you can talk about La Sera as well. But what were the general investment criteria that you had in terms of markets, hold period, risk profile? I know you mentioned the value add, separate account relationships that you created, and then the build the core as well. So were there any others, and was there a certain product type that was really the darling during that period, in terms of apartments, office, retail, and so on?
Since we were building from scratch, mm-hmm. I opened, the coastal markets, same markets that La Sera was involved in. I continued that strategy of coastal, East mm-hmm. Coast and West Coast. But then for property type, we had really nothing. So I opened it up to all of them to say, these are the 4 food groups and maybe hospitality with one, that you are open to looking at all the 4 food groups. Only okay. later, once we built a base of about 3 billion, did we add the last 5-7 years, we added niche opportunities to build. It's like building a Rubik's Cube, the gap. So we added student housing, senior housing, medical centers, data centers. Of course, we went big time with industrial, so that has paid us well. It's almost 15% of the portfolio, so that was the best performing. We also had single family housing, affordable housing, building homes that for first time home buyers and first move up. And so the niche investment started coming in the later part of the cycle as the poor food groups became too pricey.
And geographically, did you stay coastal or did it gradually that migrate inland to, you know, Chicago, Denver, places like that, Phoenix?
Yeah, it migrated a little bit in Chicago, but Denver was pretty good. It was part of our strategy.
Okay, understood. And then with the, I guess with the managers that you work with, how did you, did you ever have a difference of opinion whereby you would turn down a deal and say, it's not for us and they would want to move forward, or were generally you on the same page?
Most of the time we would be on the same page, but yeah, we rejected deals. If we say, we have too much office in a certain submarket with another manager, we might turn it down. When Phoenix, I was kind of leery of Phoenix and slow to start there. I was turning down deals in Phoenix. Yeah. And so, you know, we want to be early stage also going to markets. Portland, we were there and kind of did one deal and skeptical, but it did a good return, did very well. And same, I want to mention, you know, other downtown LA. I'm from LA and downtown has been kind of sleepy and always $2 rents compared to West LA. But the manager we had a very good strategy of converting an old building, historic building to creative office, and it's done very well. So we like, I think we've selected good partners who know what they're doing, first of all, and now also have good relationships in the local market. So we felt comfortable, but we turned down a lot. I would say out of probably 100 deals, we'll do probably 15 or 20. Yeah, very selective.
But those don't necessarily go all the way to investment committee. That could be a manager bringing an opportunity to you and saying, hey, we like this. And then you saying 80% Correct. Of the time, yeah, we understand, but it's not for us. And then going Correct. On to the next one.
Right. If something that goes to committee is probably about 30, then we approve 20.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. All right. Understood. And then I assume in what you're describing that you always use managers in the acquisition of real estate. Did you ever go direct?
We would go direct with a manager. We did two or three deals that would go direct off market transactions, but we still have to use a manager to help us in the due diligence because we don't have contracts with.
Yeah, if you only had three people at one point in your team.
So we still hired a manager to help us on the acquisition side, but yes, we have done it. We have bought, you know, we bought a $1 billion portfolio through one of the insurance companies, and we hired a manager to help us underwrite those 7 or 8 deals. And we also had our building in Oakland that we looked at, and we hired a manager.
Mm-hmm. A minute ago, you mentioned some of the different strategies you had invested in, single family housing, student housing, over time that these different opportunities came up and you took a look at them. Is there any one that strikes you as a very contrarian play where perhaps you were early to the game in a certain product type and everyone else in the community looked at you and said, why are you doing this? But you look back at it and say, hey, that was a really good decision.
Yeah, I think so. I think student housing, of course, vested interest with UC and being a university, we are keen on the shortage of student housing for campuses. Mm-hmm. So that I think before did not get too much, you know, institutional attention, but now it is. It's being priced as multifamily now, but before it had a higher cap rate compared to multifamily. Senior housing as well. We think that the demographics is moving there. So we also being very careful in selecting our partners who are really good operators. And that's the secret. These are operating companies. So you're really not just buying real estate. You really need to hire people who have the knowledge and the expertise to run these assets. And I think we've found them.
Again, without naming names, did you ever have to fire any managers?
We did. We have terminated one or two managers and transferred assets to other at La Sera. I did that. But at UC, let me think. I think we had a transfer of assets. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah. When, or if they're on watch, we would tell them. We're very transparent. Mm-hmm. If they're on watch, we would say, you know, you have to turn it around or you're going to be terminated. No hidden agendas.
So they would have some notice that they were on thin ice.
Correct.
Okay. And you mentioned, I think when you were describing the portfolio that you had some international investments, what shape did those take at UC Regents?
For international, it was really investing in global funds. You know, you probably know the biggest ones. And that is our way of tapping into the international market, because there's just no way a staff of three can monitor a separate account portfolio. So we trusted that with our managers who have boots on the ground and have local teams running the buildings. And it's done very well for us.
And those were discretionary commingled funds?
Correct.
Yeah, understood.
And they were more value add and opportunistic. We lose our tax exempt status if we go international. So we were looking for higher yielding returns for our international investments. So they were mostly value add and opportunistic.
Okay. Yeah, understood. Yeah, that makes sense given the way that you were structured and manpower that you would have to invest in that manner internationally. You just didn't have the breadth to staff it, you know, to be involved more directly.
That's correct. We allocate a large amount, so we always try to get an LPAC seat, and that's our way of just getting some type of control that we are, you know, we have an advisory committee seat in every fund that we're in, that we represent not just UC, but the smaller investors as well, to have a voice in the, you know, kind of issues with the funds. And especially during the GFC or after the GFC, some managers did not really behave well, were not as transparent, did not lower fees, did not listen as much to their investors. And so those are the ones that you really are to be careful working with them once the recovery happens. But the ones who are very transparent, who reported regularly, who lowered their fees, they felt the pain we were having also. Those are the ones that I want to continue the relationship with in the future. That's what we did.
It seems like a natural human inclination to want to deal with, you know, entities or people who exhibit the characteristics you described. So I understand that. I want to fast forward to this year, because I don't think anyone predicted that 2020 would unfold even anywhere close to the way that it has. I guess that's the understatement of the the episode. But with that said, when COVID-19 arrived, what sort of effect did it have on what you were doing, you know, at UC Regents from, let's say, March through the summer, and whether you continued with any investments that were moving forward or whether you just battened down the hatches and were fully in asset management mode?
Yeah, we were really fully in asset management mode and very careful in handling the issues that we had on each property. Mm-hmm. And so focus on cash flow, preservation of cash is big, and collection issues, and also working with the tenants, helping them kind of survive through the tough times. And that's basically what the team was focused on collection, especially hospitality was shut down. And that was a big thing. But multifamily, of course, working with the tenants who are unable to pay the rents, but collections were still pretty good.
And did you have much waiting in hospitality? You mentioned that a second ago.
Yeah, very little. Separate accounts will have two hotels. That's all we had as a separate account in the portfolio. Mm-hmm. But it's still an issue nevertheless, you know.
Of course.
But mostly office, multifamily, industrial, of course, was doing well. And retail, we were very careful with retail, although it had some issues, but our retail was mostly grocery anchored. So, you know, the grocery was all doing well, but the restaurants around them were hurting. So, because they were shut down, a lot of asset management issues that we really had to deal with.
Yeah, I know that on the retail side, it's been very difficult for a lot of investors and managers because there's no one size fits all solution. You want to think that tenants at a given property are good actors and are giving you accurate financials so you can make an appropriate decision. Certainly there are some people trying to be opportunistic and, you know, they could be the only restaurant in town, and therefore this year their sales are higher 2x than last year, but they're still because of the delivery component, but then they might still ask for rent relief or say, hey, we applied for a PPP loan. So I can empathize with you that it was a very challenging time to try to weed through all that.
That's correct. I think people, their first inclination was to ask for rent relief. But then when you start asking for financial reports, and then they slowly walked away. So those are the things that popped out, right? The good actors and the bad actors. But certainly, I think a lot of them, some of them were able to kind of give kind of deferral, rent deferrals by extending their leases as well. So there's some type of concessions that are being made. And you see it. I mean, it's really very apparent that the shops are not doing well. So the managers that we have, which one you worked for before, have been very sophisticated and really very hands-on and have handled the issues very well. So we were very impressed with the way they were also transparent and having, you know, constant meetings and updates on each property in the separate account portfolio. So it's good to know that we picked good managers.
Have you seen much talk within your office portfolio about space being put on the sublease market, or that certain tenants were going to downsize significantly upon their lease expiration, whether that be this year or in the years to come? Or do you feel like you were fortunately somewhat insulated from that?
Oh, yeah. Certainly, there are some tenants who are hurting. We have one building in Oakland where WeWork had 3 floors and they gave up 1 floor. So that made us sleep better at night that it's only 10% of the building. And it's one of their most profitable, I heard one of their most profitable locations. So
that's comforting at the very least.
Yeah, that's comforting to know. Certainly leasing is stopped, you know, and there's very few leasing that's being done. So a lot of focus of property managers also on cost containment, cost measures to watch their expenses in the buildings and, really very hands-on asset management, property management. You know, that's where I think you'll succeed.
Yeah, that's great insight there. Did you have anything that was headed to investment committee in March that you had to withdraw from or pull out of, where you said, hey, the environment's too uncertain now, so we're not moving forward, and manager X, and they had to say, okay, we get it?
No, not really. We've been very careful, so nothing was really put on hold. Mm-hmm. So from the very beginning, 2020, just been very careful in investing because everything was too pricey anyway, right? Mm-hmm. So we were just very careful in finding deals and very opportunistic. So we were kind of making sure that there's a kind of a value add opportunistic bent on strategy, but we were not acquiring core assets at all. So in fact, we were on a sell mode trying to kind of review our properties and see which ones where the value creation has been completed already and try to sell one at a time. So it's and realize some gains. So no deals.
And that's largely held throughout this year in terms of additions to the portfolio. You've mainly maintained the asset management focus without having to get back into acquisitions mode again.
Correct. Well, you have to remember I left in June. So
correct. Yeah. Up until that point.
Yeah, up to that point, yes, correct.
And with COVID, it's been hard to really predict which way this is going to go. It seems like every couple of weeks that I think there's momentum in the right direction, then it goes 2 steps backwards or an entirely different direction. I know now what I think there's 11 million COVID cases. You have states like Michigan and Washington that are re-implementing very strict restrictions. You've got 250,000 deaths. I mean, the statistics just go on and on, and not in a positive way. With all of this admittedly depressing news, where do you see opportunities in real estate heading into 2021?
Well, first of all, I think retail and hospitality are the most distressed right now. So those may be attractive opportunities. we have not seen reduction, not that big a reduction in pricing on office yet, and multifamily, and especially logistics. Also hearing anecdotally that student housing that's for sale is above asking price, trading at above asking price. So there's a lot of things happening. I think
really the student housing is trading above asking price. And yeah, I guess that's because a lot of students are just staying in their dorm rooms and they want to have a place to work because they're not going to class. Cause I had been reading a lot of students had moved back in, you know, a lot of millennials and even younger had moved back in with family because they just didn't want to pay any rent at all.
Right. I'm surprised too, but this is one manager that senior team member. Yep. I have these weekly calls with women in senior positions in real estate, and they were shocked as well that because there's so much money out there and they had to deploy. So I guess if you underwrite it conservatively, then maybe if they get a little pricing discount, but I don't understand how they could pay above asking. I really don't understand, unless there's a conversion issue that they might be thinking about changing it from student housing to probably professor housing or maybe multifamily. There has to be an angle, right, to make it more stable. But right now, I think I think more distress will be coming in the fall of 2021 for office and multifamily. But if you were to invest 1Q21, I think you would look into retail and hospitality.
Yeah, I mean, clearly there's a lot of different capital, a tremendous amount of dry powder on the sidelines. And it seems like even though you may read headlines about the weakness in retail or hospitality, I mean, I think both of us could probably name 5 or 6 different entities that are looking to take advantage of that, or think that the longer term, by taking more of a rifle shot approach into certain parts of those different product types, that they can prevail, you know, over the next, you know, 5 to 7 years or whatever the hold period would be.
Exactly. And I think I know I'm talking to one operator who is acquiring hotels like the Motel Sixes that are kind of shut down and neglected, and turning them into super affordable apartments, like $500 per month on one room. And it's renting to single moms with, you know, 1 or 2 children, that they could live in a 500 square foot room and be, you know, safe and secure. And it's newly renovated and, you know, with facilities. And $500 a month is affordable. So that's the strategy. I think that would be excellent. Affordable housing is such an issue right now.
Yeah. And I presumably that pencils because, you know, some of those hotels you mentioned are in areas that are perhaps less affluent areas or more kind of industrial areas of a city. And therefore, if you're charging $500 just as a ballpark figure, you don't need to, you know, charge $4 or $5 a foot rents in order to make the deal pencil.
And they're acquiring the hotel at a cheap price per unit too.
Correct. So yeah. And do you think that they're acquiring it directly from the fee owner, or is that coming more from a lender or for the foreclosure sale? From what you gathered,
from both. Mm-hmm. Both. Some of those are owned by, you know, individual moms and pops who have created jobs for their families, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, they're ready to bail out, and this you come in and swoop those units, and it comes in, you know, just 3 months renovation, 3 to 6 months renovation, and you're done with the property, and it's leased up right away. They're very successful. So I think that's a great strategy.
Let's change subjects. I want to stick on the market, but I want to change countries. And I know that your investment career, real estate wise, has largely unfolded here in the U.S., with the exception of the international investments in the discretionary funds we mentioned before. But clearly, you still have a very close connection to the Philippines, and you know, you still identify with both the Filipino and American cultures. So, I want to ask you, what's your take from having spoken with friends and family members back in the Philippines? Where the economy stood in Manila and the Philippines prior to COVID, and how things have changed with the arrival of COVID-19 there?
Yeah, every time I visit the Philippines, I make sure I meet with developers and major players in real estate there. So I have kind of a pulse of what's happening.
Okay.
And mostly the growth has been on call centers, so a lot of creative office spaces. And the Philippines has become the call center capital of the world. And originally, overseas contract workers' remittances are about like $39 billion. And I think in 2019, it was close to eclipsing the, it eclipsed the overseas contract workers' revenue. So call centers are really a lot of employees now, 1 million employees in mainly Manila, metropolitan Manila, Makati, you know, BGC. And I've visited those offices and they're awesome. And it's really
So to be clear there, you're saying historically one may have thought that a lot of the remittance business, so Filipinos working abroad, sending money back to their families, would have been the largest and a revenue generator or GDP generator. But in this case, you're saying that the call centers for perhaps a lot of corporations that, you know, you and I both know, when we call up a customer service line or whatever it may be, that those right. jobs are staffed in Manila or elsewhere in the Philippines, and the jobs that are associated with that are well-paying jobs. And that's driven a lot of growth in the Philippines.
Exactly. And they're not just calls for, you know, for complaints. They mm-hmm. they also have sale leads, coding data, formatting documents, reading medical scans, legal briefs.
Okay, so these are skilled like jobs that are required.
Right, right. So it's back office processing operations outsourcing. BPO is very popular, and because of taking advantage of cheap labor. So an example is a friend of mine who opened up an accounting firm in a farm in one of the provinces, and all their clients are Americans, North America. And, you know, accountants just are paid, what, maybe $15,000 to $25,000. So that's $300 to $500 a month. Mm-hmm. But they're able to hire students from who graduated from Ivy League schools over there, because in the farm, it's cheaper cost of living. So they're, and it's only 1 hour away from Manila. And so they're very successful. And I spoke to their team. I thought I was expecting, you know, 30, 40 people, and they grew to 200 employees. And
it's wow. pretty amazing. That's staggering.
Yeah. He started in Silicon Valley, the two partners. And so one stayed in Silicon Valley and the other one moved to Manila to start the company. And so they brought the Silicon model. They have free breakfasts and lunch and
yeah, that's what I wanted to ask. What's the environment like there? If you work at a call center, some people may have the impression that it's, you know, some deprived worker, but what you, I think you told me in a prior conversation, it's a pretty nice environment, similar to someone working down on Sand Hill Road in Silicon yes. Valley.
Very, very, it's the new, I think the young ones, and their life starts at midnight. So they're following U.S. time, right? So at 11 p.m., I went to McDonald's. It was packed. And I said, why? Oh, they're going for their lunch. And, you know, so it's a different, it's a night and day. And then they start going to clubs and bars at 6 a.m. So it's become a 24-hour city, and almost like the new wealth, the new middle class is emerging, which is good. And the overseas contract workers, when they send their money, the first thing they do is buy a home. So the sale of affordable homes and condos have been very robust. Philippines has had 6% growth for the last 5 years, you know, and it's because of these remittances and the call centers of the world.
And housing wise, if someone doesn't buy a house, is there much of a multifamily industry in the Philippines, or is most of the apartments, when someone says in quotation marks apartments, does that really connotate a condo as we know it here, where someone owns their unit as opposed to renting
right.
it?
Right. It's very fragmented. There's no really multifamily business there. Not too many people are used to living in a multifamily rental apartment like we do. Mm-hmm. So that's something I think that needs to be developed there. And no, it's really just renting condos, and the developer might have an arm that manages the rental of those units, and you could, and they get a cut from renting it out and managing it.
I see. Okay. And then to what extent, and again, I know you haven't been there every day and, you know, getting calls about investments in the Philippines, but to your knowledge, what type of foreign capital has invested in the Philippines in recent times? You know, whether that's institutional capital from the US, Europe, other countries in Asia.
Yeah, mostly Asian investors have come to the Philippines. a lot of Chinese investors have come also because of, I think it's close to you know, their country. And a lot of casinos have been developed in the last few years. So a lot of Chinese employees are also working there. And
those casinos cater presumably to Filipinos, but largely to Chinese who are coming there as a sort of a destination, the tourists flying to the Philippines.
Yeah. If you go to the casinos, it's like a Las Vegas casino with high-end stores in Ferragamo's and Louis Vuitton. And that's not the local Filipino middle class. That's really for the very wealthy and for the foreigners and the tourists.
Interesting. Well, hopefully you can still get a cocktail when you're playing blackjack.
We could get Richard Pink's hot dogs.
Yeah. A shout out to Richard, of course.
Yeah.
So it sounds to me like you have seen foreign capital, a lot from Asia, but then also a handful of investors elsewhere in the world.
Yes. And the also interesting kind of phenomenon that I'm noticing is that a lot of Koreans are moving to the Philippines. Koreans are investing in the Philippines, learning English, investing in businesses. They find the Filipinos are accepting of their culture and their people. And so there's been a lot of Koreans that I've never seen before that have started businesses in the Philippines. A foreigner can never buy land. So you have to have ground lease on your land. But if you're a natural born Filipino and you became a U.S. citizen, for example, you're limited also to you could acquire land, but you're limited. For urban, you could acquire up to 1,000 square meters. And for rural farmland, you could acquire up to 1 hectare. So you're still limited, but you can buy land. Foreigners are not allowed to buy land at all.
Wow. So if you naturalize, let's say, as a U.S. citizen, you could go back to the Philippines and buy land, but you'd be limited? Is that correct?
I already bought 500 square meters of land. So I only could buy another 500 square meters if I do decide to acquire more.
But if you had never come over to the U.S., then it would be limitless. You could buy as much as your capital would allow you to.
Yeah, they now have the dual citizenship offering. So if you become a dual citizen, so you become a U.S. citizen and a Filipino citizen again, you have no limit on the amount of land or, you know, you could buy.
So are leasehold interests very common there then for foreign capital, or whether it's individual or institutional investors, where they just are buying a leasehold interest?
I think so. I cannot speak very directly on that. So I assume that that's the only way they would do it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That would make sense to me as well. And then if you get back to the day to day now and into 2020, what I was asking you before, and you described the effect on, you know, COVID on UC Regents portfolio, bringing it more to the cultural side in the Philippines, if you spoke to your, you know, friends and family over there, what would they tell you the ride has been like this year in COVID and in Manila or elsewhere?
It's been tough. They're tougher than us. Only one pass is allowed per family, and that's, you have to carry that pass when you get out of your house. There's always checkpoints.
And that's still the case today?
Yeah, they're very tight. They're so good. So
could you go out and like go for exercise with that pass, or are you limited geographically to 1 kilometer or 500 meters from
You have to be within your town and you cannot go to the next town. Yeah. They check you if you're a resident of the area. So you have to bring your ID and you only have one pass for the family. And I think that they have a stricter control than we do. And of course, it's the same issue, retail and hospitality. Tourism is dead. So that has hurt the country. And work from home. It has worked well for a call center. I have a nephew who works for a call center company, and he was given a brand new laptop and working from home. And he was still doing his work. So it worked well for call centers that they're just staying at home and working. They still continue to work.
And as far as bars, restaurants, I presume if you have such draconian measures in place for exiting the home, that those are largely shut down, save takeout or delivery?
Correct. And that has also made a boom in ordering online. A lot of people who were out of work started making pastries or whatever kind of food that people can order online and they deliver. So you still have the, you know, I don't. yeah, but when you, hub or whatever, you know, could deliver your food.
The equivalent of that in the Philippines has been a boon for those types of businesses.
That's correct.
So when you mentioned before the culture around those call centers, the employees and them going to McDonald's at 11 p.m. for lunch, and then, you know, at 6 a.m. going out to a nightclub, those were pre-COVID observations, I presume, except for the McDonald's, because you can't, like, nightclubs and establishments like that are all shut down.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And have you seen, so it sounds like a lot of people have been able to pivot to work from home, like the call center side, but if you own a restaurant or you have a small retail business, I guess that's been much more difficult.
Decimated.
Yeah.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I think the Filipinos are very entrepreneurial. They learn how to do businesses from home and start cooking something that the community might want. So a lot of them, it's blossomed. That's what I hear, that order online for food. If some people are isolated and cannot go grocery shopping as much, ordering from home, you know, is a booming business. It's really doing well.
That's great perspective. The last question on that front I wanted to ask you, do you know whether, could you today go to the airport and fly to Manila? And then if you could, what would you have to do when you got there? And then could you fly back to the U.S.?
I don't think there's flights. I have to be careful with this. I think there's no flights going to Manila right now, unless you're a Filipino citizen that has to go home.
Okay.
But I don't think they're accepting any foreigners in the country.
Yeah, that seems in line with what I've heard in other Asian countries, except I think Thailand opened up briefly for tourism. I forget where it is right now, but I hadn't heard from other friends of mine that the Philippines had opened up. I believe it's still closed off. To any visitors.
My brother was in the Philippines, and before they shut down the airports, he had to go back to the U.S. He went back to Seattle, or otherwise he would have been stuck there for months. So mm-hmm. he left.
Sounds like good timing that he managed to get out. Otherwise, he would have had a chance to learn all the names of all the takeout and delivery services in Manila.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay. Well, great. Let me shift to a segment called Finance and Formulas, but I want to ask you, going back now across the Pacific over here to the U.S. in your time at UC Regents, could you talk about an investment that you made that was particularly noteworthy or successful? And, you know, I realize you may need to speak in higher level terms or not identify a particular asset, but that would be really interesting for our listeners to hear.
Yeah, I think that one of the successful investments we made in New York City, because, you know, for the separate account, we were really acquiring small to medium-sized assets. So
okay.
The commingled funds were buying the trophy assets, which we could not access through our separate account program. And so one of our managers brought this property kind of in Chelsea area, which was still not kind of hip part of town,
mm-hmm.
but it was an older building. It was 30%, 40% below replacement cost, needs to renovation. And the strategy was finding a good partner who had also kind of started his own business from his dad's big company. And he was a very well-known, his family was a well-known player in New York. And
yeah, that's certainly important there for any sort of value
out of play. Connections, right. And he knew the assets and knew the owner. And essentially the strategy was to go to Chelsea and say, this property renovated, there's a retail store in the ground floor. And it did well. It was renovated, and the High Line is a few steps away from the property. And then Google came, you know, and so it became hip. And then we sold the retail ground floor, condominiumized the property, and sold it the retail floor for the price of the whole building. So we essentially owned the property for zero basis. So that
was Was that contemplated in your underwriting, or did that just materialize over the course of your hold period? And you said, well, this makes sense. Let's do this.
It was always a hope certificate that uh-huh. was not part of the underwriting. So it was gravy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we would ever have, you know, thought that would happen. That's something that's a wish list if it does happen. But when we underwrote it, it was really holding the asset as a whole.
And
I had to beg the CIO to get approval for that one because she's from New York and she says she didn't like it. She didn't like that Chelsea, you know?
Yeah. That was going to be my question. Did you encounter any reservations initially within the organization at UC Regents or what, you know, and what was the critique or the hesitancy to move forward?
Yeah. At that time, my CIO did not think that Chelsea was an ideal place to be, to invest in office. And kind of was able to say, let's just do this one and try it out. And she took a chance on us and it worked well. So yeah, I just presented deals to the CIO. There was no investment committee at that time. And it was a difficult conversation. I had to convince her that this is a good deal for us with a good partner, with a good manager. And, you know, the property is very well located and had a pretty much really changing the tenancy of the building. It's like mom and pops and changing it to more. It had little spaces and making it to full floor tenants and more creative spaces, space use. And it was very successful.
One of the things that certainly is helpful in certain circumstances like this is to play out there, see the asset and to meet with the manager. Did you do that with your colleague there at UC?
Always.
Trying to make these, because if she was reluctant to move forward, one of the ways I presume would be to say, well, let's go meet with the manager. So you get a sense of who these people are.
I always do. Mm-hmm. And then she, after the deal, she approved it. But after that, whenever she's in New York, she made sure she visited it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, part of our mantra is every deal that we acquire, the team, the investment team, the real estate team, I have to do a site inspection and meet with the manager and the operator. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we never acquired an asset without seeing it first.
And what considerations did you have on the financing side, or did you own it 100% equity?
We have to buy assets all cash mm-hmm. to have the competitive advantage in the bidding process. And then we put debt later on.
And did you experience any challenges with lender underwriting? Did they understand the story?
Yeah, no, we did not have any issues. It was very conservative underwriting on the leverage. Mm-hmm. So we had to do a low leverage and then increase it later on, refinance later on.
Do you have any sense of how the office has performed this year there as well as the retail, even though I know you sold it off? Did you hear anecdotally that, you know, certain, even after June when you left, that certain tenants were having issues, or is that been a relative fortress amidst the storm here of COVID?
I think they're having issues. Yeah. I don't think it has been kind of.
Okay. So they fit in with everything else in terms of having issues. Okay.
Correct.
Well, it sounds like selling the retail then, it was good that it's lowered your basis to the extent that it did.
Correct.
Yeah. So you have a little bit of room there in the rent and the ability to work with tenants.
That's correct.
Well, fantastic. Yeah. Thanks for going into that. It seems like that was a great move and your efforts to persuade your manager were rewarded. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. There's two other topics I want to cover as we wind down. I know that you have been, you discussed in one of our prior conversations, some of the leadership and, you know, public service initiatives that you've championed and been involved with. So I wanted to talk to you a bit about that, but first let me ask, as you were rising up the ranks in the commercial real estate world, what sort of leadership traits did you observe, you know, all the way back to when you were in Chicago that you wanted to emulate? And were there, you know, certain leadership traits that you said, oh, I'm really glad I worked for this manager because it taught me not to do that?
Right. I think the most important one is integrity, doing what's right, and being mm-hmm. a fiduciary, doing what's right for the investor, for the stakeholders, and respect. I think respect the janitor to the CEO, that you respect your team members. You know, that's one of the highest things. And transparency, always good communication skills and discipline in their underwriting. And those are the things that really I looked up to when, you know, learning the business. It's just integrity, respect for people, transparency, and good communication.
And then how did your upbringing when you were a girl in the Philippines and as a Filipino woman, how did that affect your leadership style once you, and keeping in mind the traits that you mentioned that you wanted to emulate, how did that affect your style once you were in a more senior role and had people working for you?
I think it blended well with my leadership style because I'm more like a kind of a warm and fuzzy, you know, not all business. I really like to make people learn people and know them, become friends with them. Mm-hmm. And so it's also helped me open up. I was a very quiet girl from Manila, very shy, afraid of public speaking and had to overcome all these issues. And I think it helped me grow. It helped me also open the world. I mean,
how did you overcome that? Was that just through repetition of being in a public forum, or did you take classes to get to the point you are today?
I had to get professional coaching to mm-hmm. get overcome it. Yeah. When the Lacerra position for head of real estate came about, I went to my CIO and I said, I know public speaking is my one kind of negative issue. I'd like to overcome it. And I said, I would like to request for professional coaching. Would you pay for it? And the CIO was so nice and said, of course, Gloria. And he supported me on it. And she
wow,
made
that's great.
Big,
that's really heartwarming to hear.
Yeah. She made a big impact on my life, my professional coach. And I would still get nervous, but practicing, I guess, board meetings helped. And
mm-hmm. you know, yeah, for sure.
just being with the board every month, it helped me overcome that fear. And now I can speak in a big group of people at PRIA or whatever conference, and I'm fine.
And for the listeners who may be not familiar with that, can you tell them what PRIA is?
PRIA is an organization. It's called Pensions Real Estate Association, and a lot of LPs and GPs are members. And so it's a great networking, mentoring, and really exchange of ideas. I've been very active with PRIA and mm-hmm. since I started at Lacerra and been a board member also and plan sponsor council board member. And it's really good for mentoring and also getting to know all the investors all over the world. Mm-hmm. This is not just US, it's global membership.
And prior to COVID, they would, in my understanding, they would host an annual meeting in different cities around the
Correct.
US, or I guess around the globe.
Yeah, it would have like 800 to 900 attendees, and mm-hmm. now it's all virtual.
Yeah, we'll have to see how that works out. Instead of having a hard. Cocktail in your hand, you need to go into a Zoom chat room and hope for the best.
That's right.
How have you approached mentoring junior members of your organization or aspiring real estate professionals, especially females who want to, rise to a similar level of notoriety or accomplishment that you have accomplished?
Definitely. I've been a mentor. My team member that I've had with Lacerra, when I brought her into UC, Lacerra and UC, she has grown from admin to now a senior managing director. Mm-hmm. And very, very proud of her achievements, but also I kind of speak at UC Irvine School of Business. When I talk to the students, I leave them my business cards and say, whoever wants mentoring, happy to talk to them.
And how did you affiliate with UC Irvine?
Well, because of we are UC and I get invited to speak at, UC campuses.
So it could, that just happens to be UC Irvine, but it just as well could be UCLA or UC Santa
Correct.
Barbara. Okay.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And I also co-founded this Filipinos in Institutional Real Estate, which is an organization helping young Filipino professionals in commercial real estate to assimilate and really grow better in the industry. And we've sponsored mentorship. We've sponsored kind of speakers. We have annual meetings where we invite major players in the industry. It gives them also exposure to all the major players out there. And of course, I'm always available to help mentor them. And we are now 300 strong in coastal markets, major cities. And we were going to expand in Manila, but it got, with COVID, we had to postpone it. So maybe in 2022 or later 2021, we'll have our expansion in Manila.
And have you continued to invite speakers virtually throughout the past 10 months to speak with this organization?
Yes. We just mm-hmm. had one which more about Black Lives Matter and had mm-hmm. a panel of African Americans. and had good participation. So we're still doing some sessions, and we do mentoring sessions every 2 months or so.
Well, that's great. I'm really happy to hear that. And it sounds to me like the rollout in Manila may take a little while, given what you described and the economy there, but that it'll happen.
Right. I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so. What advice, my last question on this front is, what advice would you give a foreign-born female real estate professional who wants to enter the U.S. market? Any sort of, if you were in an elevator and you had 30 floors to cover, what would you tell her?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would say is look for organizations that are kind of related to your industry. Mm-hmm. And join that. And if you could join a committee, that's even better, because then you're really engaged and involved. And lastly is find a mentor. I think I've been lucky. My mentors were, Caucasian males. Mm-hmm. I've been lucky. There were no women mentors in my time. So that's why I'm giving back now at that mm-hmm. stage in my life. But that's really what I think. The mentorship is so important. That really propels you to more success. I never thought I would be in this position when I was growing up, and look where I'm at. I'm just grateful for all the opportunities that were given to me.
Yeah, since you mentioned him before, I view my former boss Richard in much of the same way, and he really taught me the value of having a mentor who cares and the people who work underneath her or him. So
exactly,
that is great wisdom. So now is the last part, which will only take a minute or two, and I guess it's the fun part of the conversation here. Not that the other components haven't been really insightful and interesting, but I want to ask you about the cultural side in the Philippines. If you could be a tourist in Manila for, let's say, 3 days, how would you choose to spend your time? What comes to mind, where, and again, you can paint the picture outside of COVID, because I know it's hard. I mean, you just said, well, I'd go to my living room, I'd go to my bathroom, I'd go to my bedroom, and then I'd go to the elevator and that's it. But then pre-COVID, or hopefully, into later 2021, depending on how the vaccine propagates itself throughout the world. But, what would be your guidance and how to spend time there?
Yeah, if you had 3 days, I would recommend Tagaytay, which is kind of high up in the hills and about an hour and a half, 2 hours away from Manila. There's a lot of, it's beautiful. It's up on a mountain top, and the weather is so nice, and there's so many resorts or hotels and spas that you could visit. And there's also a lot of farmland that you could visit. So it's more
that's
like
called Tagaytay?
Yeah, Tagaytay.
Okay. And that would be a weekend retreat. You could go up there from Manila?
Correct, mm-hmm. correct. And it would be so relaxing and rejuvenating. I think that you could have a good time. Or if you want to fly, it's a very short flight to Boracay. Boracay is the beach is awesome. It's just been too commercialized. When I was there, it was too crowded. But everybody goes to Boracay. It's an hour flight, and it's really nice. The beaches and it's beautiful.
Yeah, I had many years ago heard of Boracay and was interested in visiting. I did not go. I had heard more recently, to your point, that it had been inundated pre-COVID with quite a few tourists, and that had some negative impacts on the infrastructure there. But
they shut it down and they cleaned it up. So hopefully now it's not as crowded as before. There's better
that's
infrastructure.
Great.
Yeah,
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And for a real nice retreat, we enjoyed a nice vacation in this island in Palawan. It's called El Nido. And it was just fantastic, where all your activities are included and you live in a casita with stilts on the water, and you just go paddle boarding right in front of your porch. And then they have a boat that will take you to another island, and we go, kayaking. It was so fishing. And they even pack your picnic basket to your own island. It's very nice.
So you don't need to think about anything while you're there.
Nothing.
Even pain, you can just put your wallet in your bag and forget about it.
Exactly. So that's what I would recommend. And mm-hmm. my son, who went there and loved it with his fiance, and would love to go back.
Wow, that sounds spectacular. I'm definitely include that in the show notes and try
yes,
to go
please.
There myself when time avails itself.
I would love to show you around.
Yeah. And then the last question I had, what would you give in terms of recommendations to a foreigner coming to the Philippines? Any potential pitfalls that he or she could fall into?
Well, a lot of things have been said about safety. It's pretty safe if you're in Manila and most of the cities that are very well populated. So I would stay there. Okay. And you don't flash your jewelry. So not too flashy with jewelry. But it's you're going to have fun. I mean, there's so much to see and people are very warm. They all speak in English. So I think, you know, you should visit the Philippines. The people are very warm and welcoming. After COVID, we would love to have tourists come again.
Well, that's, I appreciate you giving that advice. I will do my best to lead from the front when the time is right and it's a safe trip. So,
Yes, definitely.
With that, we'll sign off. But before I do so, I wanted to give a heartfelt thanks to the time you cut out today or carved out to speak with me. As I mentioned at the beginning, I know you've been pulled in so many different directions, and I'm very thankful that you're well and that you have such enthusiasm and energy for the real estate industry, as well as for, you know, mentoring people who are trying to follow in your footsteps.
Thank you. I think I'm at the stage of my life now that's giving back is what I'm good at, and I'd love to do more.
Thank you for tuning into Global Real Estate Dealmakers, the podcast that takes you around the globe to meet real estate investors who are transforming their local communities. If you want to explore the subject from this episode in greater detail, please head on over to www.globalrealestatedealmakers.com. We certainly hope you enjoyed this episode and welcome your feedback to help us better cater the content to your global real estate interests.